it's good to see you this morning. Good morning. And great to see the family down in front that was here 10 minutes early. So they've been waiting almost a half an hour for this already. The eruption of Mount St. Helens was really an awesome event to the world. But to creation science, it also gave a number of illustrations of how fast the earth can change. And consequently, my talk about the eruptions of Mount St. Helens in the 1980s is entitled, A Big Bang for Creation Science. Sprinkled ash around the world. Sent a mud flow 68 miles to the Columbia River, trapping 21 ocean-going vessels upstream. But it was also awesome for creation, as the creation scientists there were 26 eruptions, 7 explosive and 19 dome-building events between 1980 and 86. In the third one, in 3 hours, at least 200 layers of new earth was laid down in the valley to the north of the mountain. In the seventh explosive eruption, an entire river system was produced in just an afternoon and a few hours after supper in the valley to the north of the mountain. The various eruptions came and enabled creation scientists to solve wrong science that had been held forth at Yellowstone National Park for many years. So this is my eruption. This is my outline in front of us. This is what I'm going to cover. These 4 points, 4 of the 7 wonders in the next hour. Now, as creation scientists gathered this list of all these different kinds of formations that can be produced quickly, don't have to take millions of years, they began to say, well, you know, this is too much of a coincidence. It's sort of like God's in it. And so they began to say out loud, which is very shocking to most people, we think that the Lord was behind the eruptions. Some people think the Lord's behind the hurricanes. Some people think the Lord's behind the earthquake in you know, Bangladesh or wherever it was, Pakistan. And some people think the Lord is behind these many things. Well, let me give you some reasons why they think the Lord might have been behind the eruption of Mount St. Helens. As I said, there's many of these different kinds of formations. And it seems like he just wanted to have a whole variety of different kinds of formations out there for people to see that could be produced quickly. We believe that he selected the timing. This is real interesting. If this isn't an instructive event, you certainly don't want to do it in the dead of winter when you can't see the mountain or in the middle of the night or something like that or when it's raining. So the Lord chose to put it at the beginning of the one day that probably more people have off than any other day of the week, Sunday morning. I tell people, since it was a 9-hour debt, he had to start with the early service, 8:30 a.m. So this was a message from God, we believe. Now, it wasn't a message of judgment, if it had been. He would have waited until the next day. It's now been documented that there would have been over 500 loggers within those 234 square miles of forest that was destroyed in the first 3.5 minutes of the eruption. But rather, he wanted to minimize life, the loss of life and property. And so he did it in a remote area, and the ash went in a remote way. But God, we believe, selected the timing. We believe also he chose the direction to minimize deaths and to minimize loss of life of property, damage to property and all. And you know this goes along with the scriptures because Psalm 19:1 says that the heavens declare the glory of God. It is true that the Lord can teach us certain things about Himself through His creation, but certainly not natural disasters. When Psalm 46 and verse 8 says, "Come, behold the works of the Lord, what desolations He hath made in the earth." And so we're going to do that today. We're going to look at the desolations and see what we can learn from them. My wife wrote this up in this little booklet here, When God Spoke Through Nature's Fury. And Nature's Fury, of course, are the eruptions of Mount St. Helens in the 80s. And that's a free booklet that's on our resource table, book tables in the gymnasium. And you can help yourself to whichever ones you would like to read. Now, this is Mount St. Helens before the eruption. When the mountain was considered the most beautiful of the Cascade Peaks, called the Queen of the Cascades because of the beauty of the mountain. A dozen permanent glaciers near the top. Here in the foreground is Spirit Lake. Spirit Lake was a recreational paradise, nestled deep in the basin. And you notice the whole area is heavily forested. Beautiful picture, right? Beautiful part of the world. But as you look at the mountain, doesn't the mountain look very solid? Very permanent? Doesn't it look like it's going to be there for a long time? I mean, how long would it take nature to wear that away, you know, through natural, normal processes of just plain rain and wind and freezing and heat and all? Wouldn't it take a long time, a million years or so? Well, of course, it's a volcano. And as a matter of fact, that picture changed beyond recognition in just 3.5 minutes. That's what the scientists are saying now. They started with 10 minutes, 8 to 10 minutes, and then they worked 6 minutes, and now they're down to 3.5 minutes. And it's all very logical, and I'm going to tell you how it happened now. Mount St. Helens is a stratovolcano. This is a homeschool conference, so we've got to learn something along the way. So you might as well learn a word, kids. It's called a stratovolcano. See the word up there? Stratovolcano. Strato. That refers to the strata that are laid down by the many layers from many eruptions. Mount St. Helens is the most active of volcanoes in the Cascades. It erupts once every 125 years. And so, of course, as it erupts many, many times and lava flows down and the lava builds up, it becomes a very tall mountain. And so anyway, that's a stratovolcano. Let me hear everybody. Everybody under the age of school age. Everybody school age. Let's say it together. Stratovolcano. I'll try it again. Stratovolcano. Oh, good. One more time. Just for good luck. Stratovolcano. Okay. We learned something this morning, so we get credit for being in school today. Stratovolcano. Now, where does the molten rock come from? See, here's a lava tube. Come and bring the molten rock up to the top, and it comes out the top and all that. Where does it come from? Well, it turns out that the earth has a crust, and that's the hard part that holds up everything, you know, cities and people and everything. Under that is the mantle of the earth. It's real thick, like 1,600 miles thick. And the mantle of the earth is molten in places, semi-molten, semi-plastic in places. And so when great pressure builds up there, it becomes very hot, and the pressure has to go somewhere, and it can't go down because there's more pressure, can't go sideways, there's just as much. The only way to go is up. And so all this pressure is squeezing this molten rock up to the surface of the earth. Now, as it goes to the surface of the earth, of course, it has to go through the crust of the earth, which is solid. And so as it comes up through the crust of the earth, it snaps through rock layer after rock layer, mile after mile, as it's pushed up through the crust of the earth. And, you know, if there's enough push there, it'll get the molten rock out at the top. And now every time another rock layer is broken, it shakes the earth, that's called an earthquake. Well, as a matter of fact, there was something like 12,000 earthquakes in the 60 days before the big eruption of Mount St. Helens. Now, when the molten rock got to the top of the mountain, instead of coming out, it decided to stay in the mountain, and of course that meant that the north side of the mountain had to be pushed out. So the mountain is being pushed out at the rate of 3 to 5 feet a day, And by the day of the eruption, it has bulged out like 400 feet. That bulge, see, that wasn't a part of the mountain 60 days or 58 days before this picture was taken or so. The earthquake just started on March 20th of 1980, and May 18th, 1980 was the biggest of the 12,000 earthquakes, and caused this bulge, which was sort of broken up rock, to begin plunging into the valley. And then the volcanic pressures inside there that were being held in by all of the rock began exploding. And of course, that was a chain reaction as the mountain sort of blew apart on the north side and as this material plunged into the valley to the north. It's a mile below where this is happening. The valley floor is like 2,500 feet above sea level, and the area that collapsed and went into the valley, the bottom of it is 6,200 feet above sea level, and the top of it is 9,677 feet above sea level. So we're talking about, you know, there's the whole top of the mountain and the next half of the insides of the mountain all plunging down onto the valley floor, and then they say it happened in about 90 seconds. Now this is a grace of God too. There just happened to be a husband and wife, a geologist team, an airplane over the mountain at the exact second of this earthquake. This lady looked down, Dorothy Stoffel looked down, and she said she saw the north side of the mountain rippling like the waves of the ocean. And this was just for a couple of seconds, and then wham! The north side of the mountain begins plunging into the valley below, producing the largest landslide in recorded history. The stuff comes 3 miles down the north side of the mountain, 3 miles across the valley floor, slams into Johnson Ridge, 5 miles north of the mountain, quarter of it goes into the Spirit Lake Basin, lifts the bottom of that lake, a whole football field. Most of the material, though, glances off Johnson Ridge, goes down the valley, and the leading edge comes to stop 14 miles down the valley. The average deposit is 150 feet thick, and to the north of the mountain, 600 feet thick, and 2/3 of a cubic mile material, which is 6.4 billion tons. Now get this. I've whipped a lot of numbers on you in a hurry there. But get this. 6.4 billion tons is enough material to give every last person 1 ton of that landslide, which was the top of the mountain originally, and still have it one every person on the face of the earth, 1 ton of the mountain, still have a bunch left over. Now, that is an astonishing event. So they call it the largest landslide in recorded history. And that would have been the most memorable event in the eruption, except for what happened next. And we can see a hint of what happened next right there. That's a steam explosion. It's actually super hot water in the mountain that's going to be exploding the steam that's going to work its way into where the lake of molten rock is. Then it's going to explode and empty out the insides of the mountain in the rest of this landslide. But you can only see this for 30 seconds before all of the ash, all of this cloud hides the whole area. And so isn't that the grace of God to have this geologist, lady geologist, who had a camera, who grabbed it. There was 8 pictures left in the camera. Click, 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 click. 8 pictures, and then the pilot goes into a power dive to escape this cloud they could see coming at him. It's coming at him like 300 miles an hour. There is the cloud going out from the mountain. It's traveling 5 to 6 miles a minute. In 3 minutes, it rushes out 17 miles and kills trees, 17 miles to the northwest of the mountain. And in the same length of time, it goes to the northeast of the mountain and kills 2 people in a tent 13 miles from the mountain. It kills 57 people in those 3 minutes. Well, some of them died from burns later on, but the total number of casualties they estimate was 57. And of course, 234 square miles of forest is absolutely just trashed. 8,000 large animals like deer and elk are killed, millions of birds and fish, and small creatures. The guy that took this picture was 10 miles northeast of the mountain on the third ridge line away from the mountain. He figured he was safe. He said that blast cloud was just a half a mile from him in a little over a minute. That's how fast this thing was going. He got out of there with his life. Now, once a path had been cleared to erupt vertically, then the mountain erupted for 9 hours. And the reason why it continued to erupt explosively is the scientists finally figured out that the molten rock coming from deep in the earth actually had water in it. In fact, it was like 9.6% water by volume. And so, in other words, if you had 10 gallons of that molten rock, and somehow or other you could measure it all in a laboratory without exploding on you and everything, they would find that and extract the water from it, there would be 1 gallon of water in every 10 gallons of molten rock, which is astonishing to think rock laced, I mean water laced through 2,000 degree Fahrenheit molten rock. Okay, this plume here is actually pulverized rock. It's the rock in the mountain that's being blown to smithereens and going up 12 miles into the sky, 60,000 feet above sea level. Winds are catching it, carrying it to the east. Here's a satellite picture. See, there is the Columbia River that separates Washington from Oregon. And here's Mount St. Helens down here in southwestern Washington. And you see this picture shows the ash cloud. Now, this is taken a little later in the day, but within 3 hours of the beginning of the eruption, one-third of the state of Washington was darkened from the sun by the ash cloud that was going east and northeast. Some of the material actually went all the way around the world, came back across the Pacific Ocean, and came back to the state of Washington 3 weeks later. People came out with bumper stickers, "Don't come to Washington, Washington will come to you." Okay, here is the mountain. Well, the top one quarter is gone, and the next half is hollowed out in what's described as a horseshoe-shaped crater facing the north. So that's the disfiguration of the mountain. And here is the top of the forest. This is just a little picture. This is one of over 30 lakes caught in the blast. And these trees, some of them are up to 8 feet in diameter, just knocked over like matchsticks. Okay, this shows us the power of the eruption. Actually, that initial sideways 3.5 minute blast had the energy of 1,000 Hiroshima-class atom bombs. It took about 30 seconds from the beginning of the earthquake to warp up the full power in that sideways thing. And then we say, okay, it was going 350 miles an hour, so it rushed its course. It ran its course in approximately 3 minutes. Well, okay, so this is our first wonder. Mountain rearranged beyond recognition in just minutes. Didn't take millions of years. Now, the reason for all of this is because standard geology says that they examine the geological features of the face of the earth and realize that processes to produce those features take millions of years to run their course. And therefore, the earth is millions of years old. But we don't find the earth is millions of years old when we read the Bible. We read how God rolled up his sleeve, 6 24-hour days. He has the earth and the universe up and running, and everything is alive. And he says it's all very good. And that's the way it begins. And if you have trouble with that, go to the Ten Commandments, where he says, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, for in 6 days God created the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them." Not billions of years. In 6 days, God created the heavens. And we're talking about the physical heavens. Throne room of God, spiritual things, angels, I believe were all created way back in eternity past sometime, long, 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 long ago. But in the physical creation of the starry universe and the earth and those who inhabit the earth, the plants, animals, and man, created in the image of God. And I thought this is a real interesting thing. You know, people say, a day is 1,000 years for the Lord, and 1,000 years is a day. And they say, a day is a long period of time in Genesis chapter 1. And so they're not going to take it literally. And I say, okay, what about the verse that says he made us in his own image and likeness? Are you going to spiritualize that one away as well? You know, if you just hunt and peck in Genesis chapter 1, what you're going to take literally and what you're going to take figuratively, you're in trouble right off the bat. Well, anyway, the geologic world says that the earth has been here for a vast period of time because the formations take so long. So I just remind you, here we have a picture of Mount St. Helens after the eruption. Now, the eruption was 9 hours, but the damage on the ground was in the sideways portion of the eruption, which was whole 3.5 minutes long. How did the area change? Spirit Lake, now the bottom of the lake is 295 feet higher than it used to be. The valley, there, it's 5 miles from the center of the mountain to Johnson Ridge right here. And the valley in between now has up to 600 feet, in fact, 630 feet of new earth on it. You don't see any trees in the area. And the mountain is disfigured beyond recognition, and it all took a mere 3.5 minutes. It doesn't have to take millions of years to change the face of the earth. Well, that's just a local event. It just covered 234 square miles as far as the devastation of the forest is concerned. Now, let's compare it to Noah's flood. Okay, Mount St. Helens, the damage, the total devastation of the forest, less than the area of Los Angeles County with the biblical flood. It covered the last mountain, so obviously it was in the valleys. It covered the entire world a million times more as far as length of time goes. Well, the sideways eruption at the beginning of the 9 hours eruption, Mount St. Helens, was just 3.5 minutes. By the way, I was getting that. The whole energy given off was a conservative, absolutely a conservative, 20,000 Hiroshima-class atom bombs given off in those 9 hours. But the biblical flood, it raged for over 1 year. And of course, it lasted hundreds of years as the earth settled down after the biblical flood. So I want to go to the Sumatra earthquake and tsunami that occurred, in off the island of Sumatra. Was it December 26 or 27 in 2004? And let's just look at the numbers there to give an idea of what can happen in the ocean. In other words, what could happen during the biblical flood? It says that we understand that there was rupture on the ocean floor. So there was a cleavage. And the length of it was about 1.5 times as long as the state of California, and about half as wide as the state of California, and one block rose 6 whole feet, two meters, they say, approximately 2 meters. Now you got the picture? Here's the Indian Ocean, and here you have the bottom, and all of a sudden, like that, and there's this break in it, and one portion raises 2 meters, 6 feet. And what happened? 250,000 people perished. Biblical flood raged for a year. It ripped up entire continents. It produced tsunamis with storm surges a mile high. It produced 500-mile-an-hour winds. Creation scientists have been meeting in something called the International Conference on Creation in Pittsburgh every 4 or 5 years now. And they just had their fifth one in 2003. They submit papers ahead of time. The papers are peer-reviewed, and those that are acceptable then are allowed to be read, and some 40 or more papers are read in this 1-week-long conference. And they're coming to a consensus as to a model for the biblical flood. In the biblical flood, they're understanding that this business of all the fountains of the great deep were broken up. The great deep is the ocean. The fountains would obviously be at the bottom of the ocean floor, and all means worldwide. Some kind of enormous disturbance at the bottom of the ocean, worldwide. And so the Indian Ocean, Sumatra tsunami, just illustrates what could happen in a minor, an utterly minor disturbance on the bottom of the ocean. And so I'm going from the local event, the sideways Eruption of Mount St. Helens, the beginning of the 9 hours of eruption, showing you the devastation there in just 3.5 minutes. And I go to the Sumatra earthquake, tsunami, in order to illustrate what would have happened worldwide. We understand these kinds of forces, and these all make sense, and they make scientific sense for creation scientists. We don't have to take a back seat and say, well, we just believe this by faith, only because the science supports the scriptures. Okay, let's see. Okay, our second wonder then, layered stratiform in 3 hours. Now, I'll take more time on this one than I do on the next two. So this will take a good 15 minutes to get through. You notice this is about a 60-foot high cliff. A lady in front here, she's for scale. These lights should be off, please. There are three deposits in this picture, in this cliff. First of all, you have ash fallout from the day of the eruption where I'm circling. Now you notice, kids, this is different material. This looks different. How does it look different from this? Yes, just speak out. Just speak out. I can't hear anyway, so I just want people to, you know, I want a live audience, not a dead audience. I can't hear what you're saying, but just go ahead and speak out. I know you're saying something.
Good.
Yeah, layered. It's all real organized. Now, does this look the same as this? Does this look the same as this? I should hear no's. Try it again. Does this look the same as this?
No.
Does this look the same as this?
No.
Ah, great. Now we got a live audience. We're no longer dead. You're right. This is a mud flow. Now I'm going to talk about this first. It was put down this was put down the first explosive eruption. This was put down the third explosive eruption 3 weeks later. This was put down in the seventh explosive eruption 22 months later. Hey, here we got three deposits. Didn't take 3 million years. See, the reason for this sequence is that the secular scientists, they look at the crust of the earth, they say, oh, look at all the layers. Oh, these layers take a million years to put down these layers, long time to put down these layers. Well, okay, so there should be 3 million years worth of history right up there. Three deposits, right? No, they all put down in less than 2 years. Okay, I'm going to explain how that middle one was put down first. The layers in a different place. As we begin counting the layers, there's an awful lot of them, at least 200. Some of them are rather thick, you know, the guy's hand right there, so that's maybe 4 inches thick, that's maybe 8 inches thick. You notice at the bottom, you have that sort of line. That defines that particular layer in the deposit with at least 200 layers. So scientists say that this stuff has been graded. And the standard grading in depositing is coarse to fine. Okay, let's say that together. Coarse to fine. Let's describe a few of those layers right there. Coarse to fine, everybody. Coarse to fine. Coarse to fine. Okay, that's standard grading. Now, these are some larger layers. Here's a bunch of smaller ones in another place. 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, at least 6, maybe more. The size of a guy's thumb. So they go from real thin to actually over a foot in thickness. And now I'm going to give you a sequence of information. I'm going to tell you, first of all, about the event. And then I'm going to tell you about the process of laying down those layers. And then I'm going to tell you about what the geologist sees when he studies that cliff. And he looks at those different layers. See, so that's we're going to do some real careful geologic work now for the next 7 or 8 minutes. The event was the third explosive eruption, which was on June 12, 1980. Throughout the day, the plume had risen to 1,000 feet above the rim, to 5,000 feet above the rim. Now, the rim is at 8,364 feet. So that would be 9,364 feet. We'll round it off to 10,000 feet. So the plume had been from 10 to 14,000 feet above the rim, okay? And then at 9.05 p.m., the mountain became extremely violent, and the plume went to 45,000 feet, which is more than another 6 miles into the sky. It was only one-fifth of a mile to 1 mile all day long. And then at 9.05 p.m. or 9.06, 9.07 p.m., it goes up to like 45,000 feet in the air. They actually close the Portland airport for 7 hours. And the mountain really shows its stuff for 3 hours and 10 minutes and settles back down about 12.15 a.m. Okay, so the stuff is when the mud flow came through 21 months later, the geologists saw these layers. They were astonished. You could have knocked them over with a feather because they did not know there was a process that could lay down layers so quickly. What they saw was at least, like I say, at least 200 layers. And it was put down between 9.05 p.m. 12.15 a.m., which is 3 hours and 10 minutes. 190 minutes, you get two layers. Well, it's not hard to figure that one out, is it, kids? 190 minutes, 200 layers? That's better than a layer a minute. Boom! 1,001, 1,002, 1,059, 1,060. Boom! Comes another one. Just one after another. Scientists were astonished because they didn't know there was a process that could lay down layers so quickly. Okay, that's the event. Now I want to tell you the process, how they were put down. They were put down in something called a pyroclastic flow. See that word, pyroclastic? Let's try that one a couple of times. Pyroclastic flow. Let's try it again. Pyroclastic flow. I can almost hear you. Pyroclastic flow. Okay, good. Now the word is a compound word, pyroclastic. And pyro is Greek and Latin for fire. Plastic is Greek and Latin for rock. And so what a pyroclastic flow is it's actually a cloud of very hot rock. It's traveling hurricane speed. It's gas charged, which means it's not sliding on the ground. It's hurtling through the air. It's extremely dangerous. It is absolutely filled with rock. But where did rock come from? Okay, as a mountain is erupting into the sky, it's throwing thousands of tons of volcanic rock into the sky, and the rock is all different sizes. They see pieces as big as cars going up for a short distance and dropping back down. But on the other hand, the stuff that went all the way around the world, it was more like the particles in smoke. It was so small, you know, you'd have to have a magnifying glass to really see the individual particles. And so, you know, there's large and small particles and everything in between. So as that stuff is going up to 45,000 feet above sea level, which is 9 miles above sea level, of course, it has to come back down. The heavy stuff comes down faster than the light stuff, of course. The light stuff maybe just sort of floats away as a cloud. But as it comes back down, you have a constant raining of that stuff coming back to the mountain. And from satellite imaging, they were able to see, it seems as though it sort of glances off the crater and shoots out across the countryside. And if you were out there, seeing it come, it would look like that cloud that comes out of an atomic bomb blast. And it's roiling, it's boiling, it's coming like that. And it's extremely lethal. It's killed a couple of well-known volcanologist in the last 10 or 12 years or so. I tell people that if scientists were caught in a pyroclastic flow, in the first second his body would be shredded to little pieces, and in the next second the pieces will all be vaporized. You wouldn't find a trace of the guy. So that's how lethal a pyroclastic flow is. But as the cloud goes out and away, and this is a continuous process, like that, as the cloud goes away, it begins to lose its energy and sort of drop to the ground, and the stuff is skipping along the ground, and then the stuff begins to sort itself. And as it sorts itself, a little bit behind, some more is sorting itself and forming another layer. So you know, you got a layer started here, you got a layer back here, a layer back here, a layer back here. Of course, we got to go way back, but because we're talking about at 100 miles an hour, whatever it's going, it's covering a lot of distance in a hurry, even in a minute. It's traveling a whole mile. Okay, so maybe a mile between layers, but nevertheless, they're being put down real quickly. Okay, so you got the idea of how the layers are being put down. It's just incredible. J- just layer after layer after layer after layer being put down in no time at all. Now, what does the scientist see when he studies what those layers look like? He says, first of all, I see normal bedding. You know, course defined. Let's try it again. Course defined, course defined, course defined, course defined. Hey, are you with me? Let's try it again. Course defined, course defined, course defined, course defined. Well, the second thing they find is cross bedding. One there comes across like that. Another one, it comes across shooting across a little bit different, like that. See how it's cross? Cross bedding. Oh, by the way, the layers the scientists call beds, just to confuse you. They want to give it another word. So, can you say the word beds? Oh, okay. So we got beds. Then the scientist looks and he says, oh my goodness, here's one that apparently there was some kind of a suction. Instead of coming across like that, it comes across like that, inverse. What have you got? Find a course, find a course, find a course. Let's try that. Find a course, find a course, find a course. Okay, we got these different bedding features. Well, when the creation scientist goes to the Grand Canyon, he sees the same pattern of material. Now, do we know the process that is used, the physical process that's used to put down such a pattern? Do we know? Of course. We just saw it at Mount St. Helens. They understand it perfectly. And consequently, when you see that very same pattern of stuff in another place, you know, oh, it was put down by a turbulent flow of some kind. A turbulent flow, see, could be water, it could be volcanic, it could be dry, but it's a turbulent flow. Okay, I want to show you now the layer at the Grand Canyon that has bedding characteristics like this. It's called the Tapete Sandstones. It's the bottom sedimentary layer at the Grand Canyon. Okay, how many know what sedimentary rock is? Raise your hand. Uh-oh, not too many. When you have water, a big body of water, the ocean, you can have some stuff in it. And that stuff, of course, is heavier than water. And eventually, it's going to go to the bottom. It's called sediment. And eventually, all the stuff goes to the bottom, stuff goes to the bottom. And evolution, say, over a million years, you get a layer of earth on the bottom of the ocean. In this case, this was sand. And so, you know, the ocean washing back and forth, the waves and all that, eventually it's got sand in it, and it puts drops a little of the sand down. Now, I want to show you what the standard geology textbooks say about this formation. Like how long it took to put down, and then how thick it is, and all that kind of thing. So, here are the numbers. The 350 feet thick, said to be gradual buildup on the ocean floor. And how long does standard geology say it took? Come on. Yeah, 30 million years. Okay, if it took 30 million years for that stuff to slowly go to the bottom, what would you expect to see if you look at a side picture of it? You'd expect to see it just every which way, random, haphazard. No organization whatsoever. Well, instead, we see bedding characteristics similar to those we just saw at Mount St. Helens. Nice, orderly layers like this, course defined, cross bedding, inverted bedding, all those kinds of bedding effects. The creation scientists say, hey, there's no 30 million years of Earth history in that formation. That had to be put down suddenly. Well, the evolutionists have come halfway. You know what they're saying now? Okay, we agree that the layers were deposited quickly. All that time, the 30 million years went by between the layers. Isn't that clever? You know, so you see the layers and the deep sandstones, they'll put down quickly, but all the time is between the layers. Well, they can't prove that. They can't prove that at all. But nevertheless, that's what they're saying. Why is that wrong? Whenever the earth lays in one place for a long time, like a million years, you can have soil form. sometimes you're going to have 100 feet or hundreds of feet of soil, you know, because forests will grow and die and all that sort of thing. And so you'll have a thick and thin soil covering. There'll be erosion. And so you'll see great gorges and ravines and canyons cut through it. You don't see that at all. You just see one layer after another, just like that. This doesn't work to say that the 30 million years was between the layers. It simply doesn't work. As a matter of fact, now even secular scientists are agreeing with the world's leading creation geologist, Dr. Stephen Austin, who's been with the Institute for Creation Research for 35 years or something like that, since 1970-something. Okay, so anyway, that's my story on the second wonder. Okay, now I've got 15 minutes for the third and fourth wonder. What happens is I just talk faster. Of course, I lose everybody, but at least I get through my talk on time. Now concerning a river system formed in a single day. This is really fascinating to me. It's easy. Any of you kids, you little ones, you can all understand this particular wonder. And the reason why we call them wonders is because they make us wonder at how quickly the face of the earth can change. Okay, you see that we have Spirit Lake right here. This is Johnson Ridge up there. The mountain is over to the left off the picture. And the landslide came down and buried the drainage. The lake used to drain west down the valley here in what's called the North Fork of the Toodle River. But now the landslide has put up over 600 feet of deposit in this area right there, and consequently, there is no drainage. What's a drainage? When it rains, some of the water evaporates. Some of the water goes in the ground. Some of it stays on top of the ground and goes downhill. And the part that goes downhill produces the drainage. You know, so drops come together and form rivulets, and rivulets come together and form creeks, and creeks come together and form streams. Streams come together and form rivers that take the water to the
ocean.
Oh, now we're cooking here. We got it. Okay, so the scientist said it could take up to 200 years to establish mature drainage over these 23 square miles of the Upper Toodle Valley, and that's true. Absolutely true. But on the other hand, we believe that God wanted to show it doesn't have to take 200 years. So let me show you how long it took and how it happened. How it happened is the critical thing. See, how it happened. Okay, if you're going to do a lot of erosion in a hurry, you've got to have a lot of water. But this is the mountain in the months after the big eruption of May 18th, 1980. Now, how much water do you see at the top of the mountain? Come on, talk.
None.
this is not a trick. This is not a trick. I know some speakers, they always want to trick people into bad answers. I don't try to do that. You don't want to jerk the rug out from other people. Yeah, I know there's no water in this picture. But somehow, we got to get lots of water up there and keep it up there. How do you get a lot of water at the top of the mountain, so you can let it go all at once? That guy back there knows. Maybe it's just stretching. Okay, tell me, how do you do it? Come on, everybody, tell me. Is there any water at the top of the mountain?
No.
Of course there is. It's in the form of snow. Not liquid water. You know, water comes in three... I'm sorry for tricking you guys. Water comes in three forms, you know. Vapor, liquid, and solid. And solid, it's a solid water. See, so that's how you store this water up there at the top of the mountain so you can let it go all at once. Okay, so what date this is? March 19, 1982, which is two snow seasons after the preceding picture. You know, first the 1980-81, first snow season, 1981-82, second snow season. March 19th is just about when the snow is as deep as it gets in the Cascade Range of western Washington and Oregon. And then God sent the seventh explosive eruption, because we're going to have to change that from solid water to liquid water. And that molten rock coming out of the ground is like 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And so it's melting ice and snow. That's enough to melt ice and snow, isn't it? 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit? You don't want your stove to heat up to 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. You'll have a meltdown in the kitchen. And so it turns out there's enormous quantities of loose ash in the crater. And this crater's huge. It's a mile and a quarter from there to there. It's a mile and three quarters from the south rim to where the north rim would be if you extended the mountain up right there. It's a huge area there. And so all that water is washing the loose mud, they call the volcanic ash, they call it mud when it becomes a mud flow, down on the valley floor. And sometime by the middle of the day, the whole valley floor is covered with up to 20 feet of fresh, wet mud. Can you see how you could create a river system in a day? In the afternoon hours, as the crater becomes an oven, large amounts of water washes bigger rock through the fresh mud, begins to erode ditches. More water deepens the ditches to ravines. More water in a few hours does deepen those ravines to canyons. And by the end of the day, you have this picture. A single afternoon and a few hours after supper was all it took to erode these canyons. It took the morning hours to put down the condition, 20 feet of fresh mud on the valley floor. But once the ditches had been established, all the water went down the ditches, and the ditches just kept getting deeper and deeper through the 200 layers from 21 months before, through the land, through the ash fallout from the day of the big eruption, through some of the landslide material. There are at least five canyons in this picture. Let's count them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Three are at least 100 feet deep. The one that comes this way, and I think that goes this way, Dr. Austin calls it the Little Grand Canyon, the Tootle, because it's 1/40 the scale of the biggest canyon on the face of the earth, the one in northern Arizona, the Grand
Canyon.
Yeah, there we are. The Grand Canyon. That's the deepest ditch on the face of the earth on land. And here's a 1/40 scale one. Now, that one was said, Ken Holbein showed a middle school textbook that said that one had been carved by the Colorado River over a period of 100 to 150 million years. So what's 1/40 of that number? 3 million? Here you have 3 million years of geologic work at slow and gradual processes, you know, normal rates, uniform rates, produced in one afternoon and a few hours after supper. Let's look at a few of the features here. See how the whole area is laced with these canyons, and you notice the features of the canyons. You notice how there's these cuts going back, these sort of side canyons. These are common characteristics of catastrophic erosion. This one in the middle reminds us how flat the whole area had been, except there were hills on the valley floor, and they're still sticking above the landslide, above all the ash fallout. But look at the canyons here. They're all over the place. There's at least half a dozen going this way. And over here, to the north of the mountain is right there, see? There are about 13, I counted one day when I was standing on Johnson Ridge looking down on all of this. And by the way, what do you have there, the dark stuff? That's 20 feet of mud that was put down on the valley floor that could create the condition to do a drainage in a single day, a good-sized drainage. 140-foot high cliff, there's a guy standing right there. See, that would be the mud right there. And then that would be the layer from 21 months before. So at the beginning of the day, he'd be standing right there. There would be no cliff. He would be able to walk right across the other side. There would have been some erosion, sure. But basically, that was relatively flat area. That huge canyon cut in a single afternoon and a few hours after supper. Hey, you know what? At the end of the biblical flood, Psalm 104 and verse 8 says, God makes the mountains to rise. That's the continents lifting up. God creates the valleys to sink down. That's the ocean basins. He's deepening them to get all the water back in. There's still a lot of water around. In fact, water covers about 70% of the earth's surface today. And so the water would be rushing off the continents. And what would the continents be like? Wet, sloppy, muddy. So the water rushing off the continents would have to produce enormous erosion features. and they find these enormous erosion features all over the face of the earth. The Grand Canyon here, this picture of the Colorado River as it cuts through the Grand Canyon, that look is the characteristic look of catastrophic erosion. And even now, secular scientists are saying they believe that the Grand Canyon was eroded suddenly, not over a long period of time. Creation scientists are saying, hey, congratulations, we've been saying that all along. Well, this is our fourth wonder. Now we're down to 5 minutes. Sinking logs resembling multiple forests in just 10 years. This is a neat one because it's a clear reminder of how creation science is correcting the incorrect science that seems to support evolution. We might even take 6 minutes on this. Okay, here is Spirit Lake. It's got a lot of logs on it. And the way this happened is that that blast, even though the blast was 30 seconds after the landslide, it got to Spirit Lake Basin first, so it knocks down all the trees on the slopes around the lake, and then the landslide hits the lake. It actually sent a surge of water 840 feet up the other side. There's actually a water line 840 feet above the pre-eruption level of the lake. And all this water washed a million logs on the lake. Okay, what's happening to the logs? Well, some of them, after a time, go vertical. Now, I'm not going to give the details now. I'm just going to tell the story. They go vertical in the water, about 1 in 19. Here's a whole bunch of them beached along the shoreline. Dr. Austin, he comes up with this model of what's going on. The logs are, first of all, they're flat, and then they go vertical, some of them, and then they go to the bottom, they sit on the bottom. A winter storm brings in a layer of mud each winter, and so these logs are fixed in a vertical position at the bottom of the lake. There's like 25,000, 30,000 vertical logs on the bottom of the lake right now. And when the whole lake is filled up with mud, and people dig down and find vertical log there, they might presume that log had grown there. Big question. Did those logs grow in that place where they're standing vertically?
No.
Ah, that's great. You're still with me. And now 3 minutes to the end of my talk or something like that. I don't know. How can I do it in 3 minutes? Okay, there is three or four formations like that around the world. The most famous is at Yellowstone National Park, and the sign used to read there at Yellowstone, buried within the volcanic rocks that compose the mountain, are 27 distinct layers of fossil forest that flourished how many years ago? 50 million years ago. Oh, obvious evidence of great age of the earth. What the sign is saying, forest grew, volcanic vent destroyed it, soil formed, trees popped up, another forest was thriving, volcanic vent destroyed it, 27 repetitions of that event. Okay, a guy by the name of Harold Coffin, he wrote this book in the 80s, Origin by Design. He's a creation scientist. He loves the Lord. He read that sign, and it really upset him. The reason why it upset him is because this is what he understands when he reads his Bible. That God creates the heavens and the earth in 6 24-hour days, and global floods less than 2,000 years after that, and less than 1,000 years after that, God gives the promise of the seed of Abraham that's going to be a blessing to the world, and 2,000 years after that, the seed comes, and 2,000 years after that, we hear the gospel and accept Jesus as Savior. So the earth is less than 7,000 years old, really close to 6,000 years old. The earth is less than 7,000 years old. And here's a sign talking about 50 million years. And so Dr. Coffin, he has to go there himself. He begins studying that formation. He studies and he studies and he studies. He goes there on his vacation starting. He read the sign in 1967. He starts studying there in 1968 on his vacation time each summer. He discovers that those forests are really strange forests. And by 1978, he's completed his studies. He's written articles, a number of articles that he's found in his findings. He has a long list of reasons why those trees didn't grow in forests one after another. Those trees all grew somewhere and were transported there by some catastrophic event. He had a long list of reasons to support that model. And then the problem is, no one had seen such a process. You know, you got seeing is believing. And so then 2 years later, God sent the eruption of Mount St. Helens. We actually see the process going on. Now, Dr. Austin's going to show you the process. He's in his scuba diving suit. Here's one of those vertical ones. You can see it's not sitting on the bottom, so it's obvious that they do go vertical, some of them, in the water. And here at the bottom of the lake, he finds three vertical ones together. This one is buried so deeply in the mud, the other diver down either side, they can't even rock it. This one, they can rock back and forth, but not dislodge. This one, just sitting on the bottom. Okay, there's evidence that there's upright logs on the bottom of the lake. Some of them have root material. The root material comes out about 3 feet, and then it's absolutely torn off. Now, that goes along with the zones of destruction. So as the mountain erupted, the furthest zone out, zone number three, the trees were heat killed, but they're still standing. They're just snags. The middle zone, the trees were toppled. The zone nearest to the mountain, the trees were broken off, snapped off, or actually ripped out of the ground, a little root on the tree, the rest of the root in the ground. Now, let's go to Yellowstone. Here are two of those petrified trees in one of the 27 layers. Erosion has exposed the roots. When they study the roots of these large petrified trees at the different layers, invariably, the roots come out a short distance and they're ripped off. Normal trees, the roots go to a point. It's a Mount St. Helens event. This is Specimen Ridge. I'm not talking about the live trees. I'm talking about the 27 layers. Creation scientists have examined those 27 layers. There are 27 there. And Dr. Coffin, he found, in the same layer, he found a tree that only grows high up in the mountains, and a tree that only grows in valleys. The trees do not grow at the same elevation. And there they were in the same layer. He found trees that have absolutely no trace of a soil zone underneath them. And then a creation scientist, wanting to do a tree ring study, found suitable trees in the bottom half of the formation. And the tree rings, by the way, are like fingerprints. You know, all the trees that grow in a certain place, together at a certain time, will have the same pattern rings. And this creation scientist, working on his PhD, he found at different layers the tree rings matched. Dr. Alston sent the science to the Park Service in 1992, and in 1993, they took down the sign. No 50 million years of Earth history. Great evolutionists have said, proof positive, the world is billions of years old. Radiometric dating. Creation scientists spent 8 years, a team of seven creation scientists spent 8 years studying radiometric dating, and they found that radiometric dating supports the age of the Earth. They found carbon-14 in diamonds, which are supposed to be up to a billion years old. Carbon-14 expires below the level of detection in 100,000 years. They have shown absolutely conclusively that there was one or more episodes of accelerated radiometric decay, a million times faster than normal in the past. And so this is the DVD, the popular book, Thousands Not Billions. And if you want to read the details, 818 pages for scientists, and people want to understand the process there. Another thing that's been absolutely shown so strongly is Michael Orange here, weatherman, ex-weatherman, has spent his life working for the United States Weather Service as a meteorologist. He studied the Ice Age on the side. And he shows how that the death of the woolly mammoths was the result of suffocation from the dust produced by glaciers, moving glaciers that grind rock to dust. And that their population could have been as high as 1.3 billion in the grasslands adjacent to the Arctic Ocean. And how that the biblical flood would have produced the conditions for the Ice Age. The biblical flood would have produced vast grasslands in Alaska, the Yukon, and Siberia. And so he says these creatures, the burial of these creatures in the dust, not in the flood sediments, but in the dust above the flood sediments, is proof positive that the earth is that the biblical flood occurred. And of course, evolutionists say if the biblical flood occurred, you know, all bets are off. Starlight, Dr. Russell Humphreys has done this book the video, and the DVD, and the book on how starlight could have been created in day 4 and reached the Earth in day 6, And this is so neat for kids. Here Ken Ham and Buddy Davis in front of 1,000 kids in an audience, and they're grilling them, sort of grilling them like I grilled the kids here today, and getting them to see the reasonableness of creation. This is just a short book, Vanishing Proofs of Evolution, just a short book that we have on the book table. It's so logical, it's so clear on explaining evolution, doesn't use complicated scientific terms. Well, those are my arguments from Mount St. Helens, the earth can change quickly. We can trust the word just as it's written there. Now, this picture reminds us that life is short and soon we'll be in the presence of God. You know, the lights go out eventually. So what's important in heaven? In Revelation 4:11, we have a statement of people up in heaven, the population of heaven. They're worshiping around the throne. And here's what they're saying. Thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory. They're actually justifying worshiping God and honoring Him by obeying His word and power, recognizing the judgment seat of Christ for believers and the great white throne judgment for unbelievers. Now, why do they say that God is worthy? How did they justify it? Is it on the basis that God is holy, that God is love? No. It's such a simple thing. As for thou hast created all things. You know, you can't help but say, He is marvelous. When you look up there and there's as many galaxies up in space as there are people on the earth, there's 200 to 300 million stars in the average galaxy system. Anybody that's so marvelous like that, I want to be on His side. I want to belong to Him. And whatever His program is, I'm joining it. How about you? Thank you so much.